for if at most of you, and I'll catch up with the others of you in right after class. What we should be talking about for 15 lectures or 3 weeks, maybe 14 lectures, I'm not sure how this goes with the Monday holiday, is explorations of quantum systems. And right now is a great time to be exploring quantum systems. There's tremendous experiments looking at foundational questions, connecting to quantum information processing, looking at new materials. You hopefully saw some of this in the condensed matter exploration course as well. And I think sort of unique with this century is we're able to engineer quantum devices. So in the past centuries, quantum theory often became exploring spectroscopy, trying to understand a physical system where we had to take the physical system as it was given to us. And of course, we could control it, but we took the system as nature provided it. And today, we can engineer quantum systems. So we can decide that I would like to have this particular Hamiltonian, and we can create that Hamiltonian in the lab. We can do it either by taking an atomic and molecular system and modulating the dynamics so that we get an effective Hamiltonian. We'll talk about that. Or we can take it by starting at first principles, taking a solid-state device and engineering it to have the properties we want. And we'll talk about that. For this set of lectures, though, what I'd like to do is to describe systems that are fully understandable. So I don't want to jump into condensed matter systems where I'm going to have to tell you about two-dimensional electron gases or others and to suppress a lot of the physics to give you some effective limited Hamiltonian picture. What I'd like to do instead is to describe systems where we can understand the full complexity of the physics, look at the dynamics, and look at them in some detail. Include all of the noise, include all of the messy features of the system. And to do that, I'm going to work in small Hilbert spaces. So what we're going to do is to work for the most part in systems with discrete numbers of energy levels. And the number of energy levels that we can count on our fingers. And so we can really explore this. Now, I'm going to still talk about systems that are being explored today. And I think that one of the nice ways of talking about quantum systems is to get to the point where we can show you some data. So I'm going to talk about systems that I and my friends are exploring, a few that we're not, but mainly that are explored in the local community. And we'll explore them with experimental data and show you can get the full structure. I'm also going to try to give you a Mathematica notebook for everything we do. Now, I'm a little bit nervous about this because what ends up happening is if you describe all the physics in a Mathematica notebook, once you look at it, it makes a lot of sense. And it's very easy to say, hey, I know that. And of course, it's a very different experience if you have to develop all of it yourself. But you know, there's only so many hours in a day. And I'm afraid that if we didn't give you enough material, that you wouldn't be able to get there. So what I'll do is I'm going to give you these Mathematica notebooks. What I'm going to ask from you is that you propose experiments. These are small physical systems. And you can bring your creativity to this. And since these modalities are being studied by me and my friends, come up with a good experiment, we'll do it. We'll do it with you. Okay, so that's what I'm looking for as a way of judging your engagement and knowledge in the course. You come up with some new ideas. And of course, we'll give you some homework assignments and all that. But really, you can throw away any homework assignment and work on some new idea, and we'll be happy. Okay. Now, the modalities that we're going to look at, we're going to start with neutron interferometry. And neutron interferometry is a wonderful example of macroscopic quantum coherence. If you read particularly Tony Leggett's descriptions of macroscopic quantum coherence, they often start with neutron interferometry. And it's a matter wave interferometer, and it occupies a macroscopic centimeters to tens of centimeters dimensions. And so we'll talk about that. We'll introduce it. I'm going to spend four lectures on neutron interferometry because I want to cover this in some detail, give you all the backgrounds. What we're going to do today is talk about the basics of neutron interferometry. Then we'll get to some cutting-edge physics with that. Tomorrow, I'm going to add noise to the process, and we'll look at how to describe noise in terms of Krauss operator sums and other things that I think might be new to you. The next day, we'll talk about wave behavior, that there's some unique properties of neutron interferometry where they're best described with a wave picture of the neutron. We'll look at wave packets in neutron interferometry. And neutrons have spin, so the last day we'll expand the Hilbert space by introducing the neutron spin and the control of the neutron spin in that. So that's the schedule for that. You all have the notes, right? The mathematical file.
I haven't given it around, but
okay. So you will get it. And when you all have Mathematica 7s on your computers, and you all have some familiarity with it. If there's some challenges, come and see me. And of course, when I give you the notes, I promise you that there are errors in them. So please give me some feedback for those. I haven't even spelling corrected them, so some of the errors will be embarrassing, and hopefully not so many in the physics. There's a list of references on the second page of the notes, so have a look at those and take what you want out of those. Okay, so the challenge, I didn't go over it. After neutron interferometry, then we're going to talk about magnetic resonance. So there we're going to use spins as qubits, and we'll talk about nuclear magnetic resonance, where the nuclei are qubits. We'll briefly talk about electron spin resonance, but the idea there will be to take an electron and make it the control element for the nuclear spins. And so instead of building an apparatus, we won't have to do that. We'll have no apparatus that controls the nuclear spin. We'll use the electron as the control of the nuclear spin. And so our apparatus will be embedded in there. Then we'll add optics. So we'll have optical control that will then control the electron, that will then control the nuclear spin. Okay, so everything gets a little bit faster and hopefully a little bit more precise. And finally, we'll talk about persistent current flux qubits. So we'll talk about superconducting systems that are really engineered. You'll see that once we get down here, these things are pretty engineered as well. But this, feels like real quantum engineering because we're going to pattern something. So if we pattern it, well, okay. We can pretend that we can do anything we want. And for all of those things, we'll see some experiments as well as a theory. But we're going to start with neutron interferometry. The challenge with neutron interferometry is, as with all matter wave interferometry, neutrons meander. So we're going to have a neutron, and it's going to be flowing, moving at about 2,000 meters a second. So it's pretty slow. And it's hard to get many neutrons. Take a reactor. We'll have a reactor source of the neutron. So over here, I have a reactor. And here I have my interferometer. I'll draw it in a second. From the reactor, we're going to get about 10 to the 14 neutrons per square centimeter per second, which sounds like a lot. But very few of them will have the right momentum for the process. And what we'll do is in our neutron interferometer, we'll take a single crystal of silicon, and the blades the crystal lattice runs this way. And we'll have the neutron beam impinging on it, and we'll use Bragg scattering to define two paths coming out of this. So the neutron interferometer is going to be a Mach Zehnder interferometer, and that you're familiar with from optics, I'm sure, in your physics classes. And so we'll have two paths coming out of here. And it'll be based upon Bragg scattering in the Lowy geometry. Maybe you're not familiar with that, but the Lowy geometry is a forward scattering geometry. Okay, and that's why I want the blades this way. So I get a reflected path, transmitted path, and a reflected path. If I use silicon, then of course, silicon makes a beautiful perfect crystal. It's wonderful in that we can have really big perfect crystals of silicon. But the periodicity is set by the crystal. And what we need here is to have a wavelength of about 2.3 angstroms. It depends, of course, on exactly what we set that angle. OK, so now then, if I say I'm going to select out those neutrons out of the reactor that have 2.3 angstroms, so that's, those are thermal neutrons. You know that every neutron in a reactor is born hot, right? It's a nuclear process, right? Neutrons are created in a reactor with very energetic particles. So what we need to do is to put a cold source here. We'll put hydrogen. We'll keep it cold, about 20K, 40K. And we'll try to arrange a beam to come out. I should have drawn this. Well, it doesn't matter. I should have drawn this down here, but we'll have a beam coming out. And the neutrons will be forward directed in that beam. And in fact, it's not such a bad description because we put a crystal in here and we scatter. And then we put another crystal here and we scatter. And so there's a set of monochromators to select out only that fraction of the neutrons that we want. Okay? And I described this a little bit more in the notes. And it's something that you've all heard before. So I'm not going to describe it more now. Now, yeah, please. A cold source is a pool of hydrogen that's kept cold that the neutrons scatter over. And so you know that the cross-section for scattering with hydrogen is very high for a neutron because the masses are about the same. And so it's very effective at exchanging energy. And so we're going to have a pool of hydrogen. We'll scatter the neutrons there. They'll thermalize with that. And we'll get a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of energies coming out. It's a little bit funny to get a Maxwell-Boltzmann because there's no interaction from neutron to neutron. But there are very strong interactions with the hydrogen, so we end up with a Boltzmann distribution anyways.
Do you have like a gas inside the chamber, and then you put a little hole in it to make a beam of?
That's essentially right. So we try to direct the neutrons with one momentum into the beam guide. It's very hard to confine neutrons at these energies. Yeah. Yeah.
How did you come up with 2.3?
So we have the periodicity of the crystal.
Right.
And then I say, hey, I need this separation, this angle,
okay,
to be finite. So I'm going to choose that angle so that I have a good scattering pattern. Yeah, and let's talk a little more about that right now. So since we have so few neutrons, in fact, at our detector down here, which is a helium-3 detector, which I described in the notes as well, helium-3 detectors are wonderful. They don't miss any neutrons. The quantum efficiency is very high. But still, there's only about 2,000 neutrons a minute that reach that detector. So it takes a very long time to do any experiment with a neutron interferometer. And so it's very difficult to align blades. We don't want to have a neutron interferometer like you see with optical systems. With optics, you would have a set of separate beam splitters, a set of mirrors. You would align everything. You could align each component individually. With neutron interferometry, we can't do that. We would never have the sensitivity to align them. And so what we do is we take an idea from Bonza, who developed this for X-rays. Forget that electron stuff. That we would create one single crystal, and we would machine out of it. So if I look at this on the edge, it looks like this. So I take one crystal of silicon, a macroscopic crystal of silicon, and I machine out of it these three blades. So I cut away everything until I have three precise blades. Because of the blades are all from the same single crystal, they come perfectly aligned. So if I align the first blade for the scattering experiment, for the Bragg scattering, then the second blade and third blade are automatically aligned as well. So we only have to do the alignment once, and we can see the whole dynamics. The other benefit is that the crystal behaves as a solid body, so that I only need to worry about vibrations of the entire crystal. I don't have to worry about vibrations of the individual blades themselves. Okay, so then we have our two beams coming out, and out here we're going to look with these helium-3 detectors. Helium-3 is going to capture a neutron. It will decay. You'll have two charged particles. Life will be good. Tritium and a protium, of course. And so we'll be able to detect the outcome of this. All right, so this is the basic setup. And now let's think of, yeah.
When we asked you about the wavelength, you said that we need a certain angle.
Yeah. So
the wavelength could be related to it by Bragg scattering or something.
It is.
One could again ask, why do we need a certain angle?
So I've got a crystal here that is 10 to 15, maybe a little bit longer, centimeters. And since I want to use the interferometer to explore quantum physics or to explore soft matter physics, I would like to be able to put a sample in one of these blades. I want to be able to put something in this leg of the interferometer without affecting that leg of the interferometer. So I want these two paths to be macroscopically separated. And so that tells me that this angle needs to be a certain amount. Yeah, that's right. And this width, 8 centimeters about, right? So we try to use as much real estate as we can. Now, what happens, of course, is there's some more details that you come in with a finite width blade beam. So the beam is typically 8 millimeters by 2 millimeters. And when it interacts with the blade, it broadens, of course. And so as you're going through here, the beams get broader and broader, and so you need to worry about that broadening effect. And that's described in the notes as well. Other questions? OK, so then let's go and describe the physics that we would like here. And you'll find there's a lot of stuff in the notes that I'm just going to skip over. Now, a good way of thinking about this is that we actually have two beams incoming. So that I have a system that I could describe in SU2 here, SU2, SU2, SU2. And somewhere there must be an eraser. So let's lose the stuff that we don't need. So we need to define some vector space so that we can talk about quantum mechanics in the system. So I'll take Z out of the board, X and Y as I've written them. And we'll take the state 0 to correspond to Kx positive, and 1 to correspond to Kx negative. You know, there's no magic. I could have defined this in a different way. But this is convenient. So if we have the particle coming in on this path, then it's in the state 0. And since it's an initial state, we'll describe it as a density matrix, that the incoming state is with probability 1 in the 0, 0 state. OK, and that's easy to arrange. We don't send any neutrons that way. Okay. At the first blade, we think about this as a beam splitter. And the first blade, we'll describe a propagator for that. Which is a Hadamard transform. So that you've heard about in Daniel's course. And so the first blade, if it's an ideal blade, if we've set the thickness of this blade so that there's an equal superposition of the neutrons taking the upper and the lower path, then we have this nice propagator for that blade. The middle blade acts as a mirror. And unfortunately, for thermal neutrons, we don't have any mirrors. So what we do is we have a Bragg event at the third blade. And you can see that certainly there has to be a probability that the neutrons will be transmitted through that blade. These neutrons will leave the experiment. There's no probability that they'll ever reach the detector. We can arrange that experimentally quite easily. And in leaving, we're going to make an assumption called the fair sampling assumption. We're going to assume that there's no interesting information, no unique characteristics of those neutrons that leave the interferometer. So we're simply going to rescale our density matrix. Half of the neutrons leave. We're going to rescale the density matrix by a factor of 2 to keep the density matrix pure. OK, and then the mirror here has a nice feature. OK, then it only acts to swap the states. OK, so it's very easy to see that if I send 0 into this, I get out 1. If I send 1, I'll get out 0. Now, of course, you know what happened here was because of my choice of basis as the sign of the momentum, then I was forced to treat this mirror as an actual unitary process. Alternatively, I could have said, hey, that path is 0, and the other path is 1. In which case, I could have just dropped the dependence on the mirror, right? The middle blade would have done nothing. I could just remove it from the calculation. But OK, I like this definition, so I'm going to use this one. And we'll keep that in there. Now, the third blade is exactly the same as the first blade. OK. And so now then, we could go ahead and calculate the state coming out of here. OK. All I would need to do is to take this density matrix, propagate it through there. So I could say, oh, yeah, OK, we'll take the state. That, and we'll have U of the blade, U of the mirror, U of the blade, and of course it's a density matrix. And I would get out of here the output state, all stuff that you know, I'm sure. And then, of course, we want to say, OK, we're going to make a measurement with the helium-3 detector. And the helium-3 detector is set up to detect either the O or the H beam. OK, so those are old nomenclature from interferometry. And I'll show you in a few minutes that the O blade, is the O beam, is a little bit nicer to look at. Okay, but we can choose either one of these. And of course, if we're going to choose them, then we have to say, well, what's the measurement that we're making? What's the measurement operator? And so the measurement operator here, we have the state up. Okay. So we're projecting Kx positive. Here we're projecting Kx in the negative direction. And of course, if I want to measure the intensity at the O beam, then that's the trace of that projector in the density matrix. Yeah. And vice versa, if I wanted to do this. Now, that's a pretty boring experiment. We need to add some control to the system. And so the way we're going to add control, I drew in that sample before, but we're actually going to add in a phase shifter. And experimentally, it looks like this. What we do is we take a material that has a very low reactive cross-section, so a material that is not going to absorb neutrons, that has a convenient coherent scattering cross-section, so that has a nuclear interaction. And it could be silicon, it could be aluminum, it varies. We need to be able to machine it precisely. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to rotate it about that direction to change the path length of that of the neutron beam over the sample. Okay? And you can see that because these two paths approach the this phase flag from different directions, then naturally the path length is different in the two. And we're just going to rely upon that for this. And so we'll have a phase flag and the phase flag I guess it was zero. Looks like so. Okay, it's just going to write a phase in each of the paths. Yeah?
Aluminum block shift the phase of the thin coating.
Thank you. So there's a few reasons. And the first is just a nuclear interaction. It says that you have a neutron that's going to interact with the atoms in the material. And so it becomes the so-called optical potential. And phase, well, the potential, let me write it down correctly. The potential function is the sum of the coherent cross sections over all the atoms in the system. This isn't a very useful way to think about that. It's much nicer to say, I have a uniform sample, which is what we're going to use in these systems. I'm going to integrate over it, in which case the phase is going to be the number density of atoms. You'll have a term that is, again, the cross-section, the wavelength of the neutrons, and the path length. I'm not sure why people choose D as the path length, but that's the path length. And so as we rotate this, what we're changing is the path length. Now, neutrons interact in many different ways. And so in addition to this coherent cross-section, of course, there are reactive cross-sections. There are also magnetic cross-sections. The neutron has a spin. And so there'll be a magnetic potential that is proportional to the magnetic moment of the neutron times the field. And again, it's going to depend upon the wavelength or the momentum, and it'll depend upon the distance that it's traveling in that field. Okay, so those we'll actually get to this later on today. Yeah, but that's what those are. And I give you a brief description in the notes as well. Yeah.
This only introduces a phase shift and no amplitude decrease.
That's right. That's a pretty good approximation for these materials, that there's a very low absorption cross-section. And we choose materials that way. Now, of course, you could put something like gadolinium in there, and then you would see absorption. So we could use an interferometer to measure absorption, but at this point, we'll use it to look at the coherent cross-section. Yeah?
In this case, was a fair standpoint assumption was, again, rescale the density matrices to say that small amount of absorption is not noise?
It would. And since at the end of the day, we're rescaling here, we're not actually monitoring this value to rescale, we wouldn't experimentally know the difference right now. But it's a good point that it could be another contribution to fair sampling. The reason that the measuring here doesn't help us very much in rescaling is that we have a broad, even though we have two micrometers before this, there's a broad momentum spread, broad relative to the acceptance of this crystal that says, hey, I have to have three Bragg scattering events to hit a detector. So if you look at the momentum distribution here and you look at the momentum distribution here, they are different. This takes a piece of that broad momentum distribution. It always takes the same piece, but it takes a little piece of it. Yeah?
They use the imaging as why that form? Why is it going
for the blade?
The
so if I take an input state that's 0, 0, and I act on it by this blade, I'll create a state coming out that is going to be, well, let's just do it as a pure state. There'll be an equal superposition of taking the two paths. And that's the physics that we have with the diffraction event, with the Bragg scattering event going on here. Okay, so that's the correspondence. If you said, hey, calculate for me the structure of this, we can do that with dynamical diffraction theory. But that's quite a few lectures, which we're not going to do. Okay, but there's the correspondence that says, if I have Bragg scattering at a blade, then the output is a coherent superposition of the neutron taking two paths. Yeah?
The separation of the beams is going to be 45 degrees.
It's not 45. I know what it is because I know the crystal, but I don't know. I don't arrange for it to be 45. I arrange for it to fill the interferometer.
I mean, the reason I asked is when you apply Hadamard.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're saying, how do I know it's an equal superposition of 0 and 1?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm going to come to that. That's a very good question. Let me save it for just a few minutes. Okay. So if I take and introduce the phase flag here, right, so we've got the blade. I'm going to stick in here. New phase. And notice that I've written the phase with two angles, but we can factor one of those out, right? And that angle become a global phase. And that global phase better not have any influence on the physics. And in fact, it won't. So let's just write down the phase with one angle. Okay. And so we'll say, oh, yeah, that angle is in the upper blade. So I'll change this to alpha, make that 1. And if you like, put a phase factor in front, but we'll never be able to see it in this particular experiment. Then the output density matrix in this case and I'll try to get it right. Has this form. And we can see that if we look at the O beam or the H beam, what we're going to find is 1 plus or minus cosine squared alpha. And it's boring to look at. So let's just look at the data. So if I grab this. All right, so I went ahead and calculated, but of course, 1 plus cosine squared or 1 minus cosine squared, you want cosine, just looks like these curves. There's nothing interesting there. But now let's go back here. Here's the real data. And this is a pretty good contrast curve. And you can see that one takes us almost a minute to collect 2,000 neutrons. So it is a slow experiment. Here, this is the change in thickness of that silicon blade. Okay, so you can see that 100 microns corresponds, in this case, to something more than a pi phase shift in the something more than pi over 2 phase shift in this particular case. The O beam intensity here doesn't quite go down to 0, but it comes close. The H beam intensity is, of course, out of phase. If I integrated across these, then what you would find is that the intensity does not change as I change that path length. The fact that these meet here is purely accidental. Okay, and this is your question. You said, well, how do I know that the system should have equal probability or equal superposition? And in fact, it doesn't. When we take the neutron interferometer, we can define probabilities of going in the two directions as a transmission and reflection coefficient. And we machine the system very, very carefully. So what we hope is that the transmit and reflection coefficients at each of the blades is the same. And that is very close to the case. And so if I look at the O beam, then you can see that if you take the upper path, you get transmitted, reflected, reflected. So transmitted, reflected, reflected. So that's the upper path. If I take the lower path, I get reflected, reflected, transmitted. And so the coefficients in front of the contrast curve are the same, regardless of which path I take. For the H beam, that's not the case. We're down here with the H beam. For the H beam, if I take the upper path, I have transmitted, reflected, transmitted. If I take the lower path, it's reflected, reflected, reflected. So And that contributes to this shift of the neutron amplitude. And so what happens is that the H beam is brought down from 1, from full intensity, and the O beam should be brought up from 0. Okay? It doesn't yet explain why there's a separation here. Okay, so we'll have to look at a little bit more physics to see that. Yet another question.
Yes. The transmission and reflection coefficients are different, right?
Yeah.
So when the first blade acts, it's not going to equally split the beam.
That's right.
When we represent it as a Hadamard.
Yeah, we won't. That's exactly right. And so what we want to do is right here. What we're going to do is, instead of having all of these weights equal to essentially 45 degrees, we're going to simply insist that t is cosine squared of an angle, sine r is sine squared of an angle, so we define a new propagator. And that includes all the physics. Yep?
Thank you.
And since it's there, let me not write it on the board, because I see that I'm going to run out of time. Is it? Okay. I'm going to skip some things, but I'm not going to skip this. This is the guy who took all the data, Dima Pusha. He's the one who sits around there and looks. Okay. So now, let's come here. If I look at the O and H beams, and I vary the transmission coefficient, then what you see is exactly what we described, that the O beam is shifted down. So it always should cross zero, but it doesn't reach full intensity. And the H beam should reach full intensity always, but it doesn't reach zero. Okay? And I ask you in the notes to look at this, because this is a simple story. It neglects what happens at the middle blade. In this simulation, I've assumed that the middle blade still acts as a mirror. And if I'm changing the reflection and transmission coefficients, it's not quite fair to leave that middle blade alone. Yeah? Okay. Now then, let me just do two quick things. What happens in this experiment? So here, I've taken my interferometry experiment. So let me describe this picture to you. These things are supposed to be the three blades of the interferometer. Okay? Here's my incoming path, and I've labeled with colors just the eigenbasis of that particular path. Okay, just so that you know that we're labeling things based upon the momentum. At the moment, let's just think about everything as perfect blades, so the transmission reflection coefficients are equal. Here's my phase flag. And so I arrange the phase flag. This is a beam block, but let's leave the beam block out of here. Let me arrange the phase flag so that all of the neutrons appear in the O beam, for instance. I can do that. Having arranged that all the neutrons appear in the O beam, if I block this leg of the interferometer, what happens at the detector?
You should get an equal superposition.
That's exactly right. So it looks very much like the incoming state, that we get an equal superposition in both of those. Yeah? Good. You understand that, you know most of quantum mechanics. But we'll still put a few more things in, not to worry. Okay, now I'm going to look at something that is similar. We'll take our neutron interferometer. I'm going to put a material here, which is a magnet. So it has an internal magnetic field. And we said that there was a cross-section that depends upon the magnetic moment and the field. Okay, so here I have my incoming neutron beam. And it's, neutrons are a spin 1/2 particle. So we can think about them as a dipole. They're going to interact with this field. We'll take the field coming out to the board for the fun of it. In the incoming beam, in this particular case, is not polarized. So the incoming beam is an incoherent superposition of neutrons in those two states. Right? So the incoming beam has a probability of being up, or it's a probability of being down. And there's no coherence in the incoming beam. And the probabilities are equal. I could make a spin-dependent detector. I'm not doing that now. I'm only looking at the O-beam cross-section. Now, clearly, if I have a potential here, this is a matter wave, right? So if I have a potential there, then the neutrons see that potential. They'll be slowed down or sped up by that potential. And therefore, there will be a phase shift associated with this potential. And so now I have a spin-dependent phase shift. And I show you that right here, that in this experiment, we've taken spin. We've broken this experiment into two pieces, and I've prepared the initial state as spin up or spin down. Okay? And so we see that there's separation between the contrast curves depending upon whether the spin is up or down, and that separation is exactly this magnetic cross section. So that separation is mb lambda d. Put it as mu, I did before. And the phase is plus minus that. What do I see if I now take the incoherent superposition in the same experiment? So here we said, we'll take spin up, we get the blue curve. We take spin down, we get the other curve. And now instead of taking them as up or down, I take an equal mixture of up and down. Absolutely. So quantum mechanics is linear. So we should see the average of those two. There's no coherences. And interestingly, this is an effect that gets botched in the literature. Clearly, if I take the average, I'm going to lose contrast, right? If I take the average here, I'm not going to go down as far as I did. I'm not going to go up as far. And so if I take the average of this in this figure, if I can find it, and I change the angle of the phase shift into the magnetic cross section, then we see that we lose contrast, and then we regain it as that angle increases. And it's a periodic function of that. And if you look at this picture, it's a little bit weird to think about. But if you let me draw the same picture where I've drawn, let me go back down to low phase shifts. I've drawn the curves that are spin up, spin down, and the average. Okay, so as I change the difference in phase shift between spin up and spin down, you see spin up, spin down, the average for the O beam and for the H beam, you see that these spin up and spin down maintain full contrast, but that the average, of course, doesn't. And that as we shift these away from each other, that when they're 180 degrees out of phase, it's not surprising that we lose all contrast. When they go past each other, we recover the contrast. But of course, it looks like we have a 180 degree phase shift relative to the original contrast. There's no shift other than that 180 degree phase shift. So this is an amplitude modulation of the contrast curve due to the magnetic field. And of course, these processes we can describe as a unitary dynamic. This average process we can't. And there we have to describe it in terms of a sum of operators. Yeah, and that I know you saw with Daniel. So instead of having this simple term here, now what I would have to do is to describe it as a sum. And in this particular case, it's very easy because the sum is over two different phases. And so I'm just going to average over those two phases. Okay. Now, this description keeps all of the physics in it. And there's a more compact description using a superoperator where we say, what is the effective map at some moment of time? I'm pretty sure that Daniel went over that too. What's that?
Superoperator.
Yes. I'll describe it. Tell me how much time I have. When do I need to vacate this room?
About 5 minutes.
Okay. So let me think if that's what I should do next. Well, I've said it, so it's only fair to show it. So if we take this operator sum, I'm going to describe the action of this device, this interferometry, as a map over this Hilbert space. So I want to take every operator in the Hilbert space and tell you how it's mapped to every other operator in the Hilbert space. And that will be the superoperator. Now, you might complain, and I would listen to you for a second, that there's only one input state that we're allowed in this case. But I'm still going to define a map of the superoperator of that system. And so the map is going to allow for any possible input states, even though experimentally we're only going to access this particular one. So if I want a map of this system, and the system's living in SU2, then we know that there are four operators that span SU2. And we can just take the Pauli bases of those. And so we have the operators that span our system of the identity sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. And what I want out of this operator is to say, hey, what is the mapping of these to each other? So I'm going to move from Hilbert space to a Liouville space, or to a superoperator space. And in this space, the operators in Liouville space are, the vectors in Liouville space are these Pauli operators. Okay, so now we'll define a basis and I should indicate that they're in a superoperator space. And so now I can define, what's that?
What is that symbol you
do? Oh, just a tilde.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure what did Dan use.
I use the XYZ.
Okay. So here we're going to define a superoperator over this. And notice that we have a convex sum over actions. So I'm going to say, yep, I'm going to take the trace. If I think about the ij element of the superoperator, and so let me call this just so that I have an index in this. And I can say, oh yeah, this is going to be, and then the sum over these effective operators and some input state and we'll define this as the effective propagator sub I. Yeah, superscript I. And let's call it K here, and sum over K. And so now I have a map. And if the actions that I'm describing are correctly described this way, and I put a probability in here, I need a classical probability. Right, I need to say that, oh yes, in our case, this phase happens with probability 1/2, the spin being up, happens with probability 1/2, the spin being down. And so we're going to average over those two. So I need a probability here. And in this case, if you've heard of Krauss operators, these look close, but they're not it. So don't go jumping the gun yet. Okay, here we just have a convex sum over unitary processes. If we have convex sums over unitary processes, then this map is completely positive and easily defined over the whole system. I've got to stop. So what I'll do is I'll pick up and go over this piece again tomorrow. This will be important in talking about noise. Okay? So we'll do that all again tomorrow. Yeah? Other questions? Chase out of here probably. Okay. So you'll get the notes. What I would like you to do is to show me that you can use an interferometer that's only 10 centimeters long to detect gravitation, the gravity shift of a neutron. Neutrons are pretty light, but they are, in fact, massive particles. And 10 centimeters is plenty of space to detect a phase shift from gravity. Of course, if I want to detect a phase shift from gravity, I better arrange to have two paths that have a potential of cross them, right? So you'll show me how to do that. Okay, thank you. Also in the notes, there's a bunch of questions I have in the notes. I think there's a couple dozen. And those are not questions for you to do as homework. They're just questions to say, hey, stop and think a second. Okay? And so don't think that all these questions in the notes I'm expecting to get anything back from. If there's any that you don't understand, I'm happy to go over them. And there's some interesting features that, as we continue on with this, that you'll see to talk about. But at the moment, take those, think about them as you like, look through the notes. But work on that gravitational problem. Thanks. There's